to do with immigration and its impact on the recovery. We got more undocumented people in LA than any other city in the country. I think it's 10% of the population. They are the prime targets standing in Home Depot parking lots. Not the worst of the worst, but the people that are engaged in the rebuilding of Los Angeles are the ones being targeted by the ICE raids right now. We've seen people run and die getting hit by cars on freeways by these operations. You know what they're doing? They're trying to find work rebuilding homes in Altadena and the Palisades. That's who the Trump administration is targeting, as Gavin Newsom points out.
We just have 20 seconds. People losing their homes, their property. They already had their houses burned down.
Well, and here's the thing. 40% of the homes and the lots that are selling now are going to corporate investors, not locals. LA is the most unaffordable city in the country and the most unaffordable state in the union. This book will show you the fissures that lie beneath our society that are exposed when a firestorm like this happens.
Jacob Soboroff, senior political national reporter for MS Now, new book, Firestorm, The Great Los Angeles Fires and America's New Age of Disaster. On Monday, we'll speak with filmmaker Andy Timmerer about her film, All the Walls Came Down, about losing her home. We'll also speak with the main protagonist, the community activist in Altadena, Heavenly Hughes. That does it for our show. The film has been shortlisted for an Oscar. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland, and you don't want to miss it. To snag your copy, visit kboo.fm/zine.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development and Events Committee meeting will be held on Monday, January 12th at 5 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Make America great again. There's so many different interpretations of America being great. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
It didn't start with Trump's Make America Great Again. Presidential slogans have always had to live by very specific rules. Keep it short and memorable for easy recall. Focus on a central theme that resonates with voters. A bit of history. In 1856, it was free soil, free labor, free speech, free men, and Fremont. Fremont did not win, by the way. In 1860, Lincoln's was vote yourself a farm. Imagine that. McKinley in 1896 was patriotism, protection, and prosperity. And in 1956, for Eisenhower, it was quite simple and it turned out to be accurate. Peace and prosperity. Reagan's brilliant lines were, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And then in 1984, it was, it's morning in America. I think we can all see the pattern. All presidential slogans say virtually nothing, but are short and memorable. The term Make America Great Again fits quite nicely, and the citizens can apply our own interpretations to it. Today, with one of our favorite historians, Michael Kazin, we'll look at what does MAGA mean? What does Make America Great Again mean? And more importantly, what can it mean? His new essay, The Two Faces of American Greatness, should raise our curiosity and, one hopes, take action to live even closer to our highest aspirations and do what we can that we think will make America great, to carry out Lincoln's idea of creating a more perfect union. Michael Kazin's most recent and, I think, highly important book, which we discussed back in the spring of 2022, is What It Took to Win, A History of the Democratic Party. And you can listen to that discussion, which I encourage at any time, on this website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Michael Kazin, thanks so much for being with us again on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Great to be here again.
Yeah, good. Michael Kazin is professor of history at Georgetown University. He's also written a number of books. A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, whose fight against the teaching of evolution is still incredibly relevant. It's hard to believe. He also wrote American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation, The Populist Persuasion in American History, and one of my choices for most important book about the unfortunately little-known but important tradition in America's truly great identity, the book War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914-1918. Michael Kazin was also, for nearly a dozen years, co-editor of Dissent magazine. Good credentials. Note I said it's a memorable, little-known but truly great American identity, American Fight for Peace, to keep us out of that war. Today, in the shadow of Trump's remarkably ugly interpretation of American greatness, we'll try to inspire our own thinking about what makes America truly great and how we can work toward a reinvigoration of that version of greatness. Well, as regular listeners, they're probably tired of hearing me say, one thing we've learned from history is that we never learn from history. Professor Kazin's subtitle for this essay says, it is the task of historians to grapple with Trump's favorite concept and to redefine it. So let's start by asking, what did Trump's campaign, his handlers, I'm sure they thought of it, intend MAGA, Make America Great Again, to be understood as by the people of the U.S.? What was their intent?
Well, I think the brilliance of that slogan, and you know, as much as I dislike Trump, I have to give him credit for coming up with a brilliant slogan, and perhaps his handlers came up with a slogan, but he certainly has popularized it because it is ambiguous. It does obviously hark back to some imagined time when things were better, perhaps when prices were lower, when there was America was the rivaled, you know, most powerful country in the world, perhaps when, and this is what, you know, of course, a lot of people fear, people, progressives fear that perhaps when men, especially white men, ran the country, ran the culture, everybody else had to do their bidding. But I think it speaks to a discontent that a lot of Americans do feel that, things aren't going well in this country, that polls show you that routinely for the last 20, 25 years when Americans are asked, you know, are things going well in this country, they say no. They think things have gone bad. And so the slogan is brilliant, not just because it fits on a baseball cap, which, of course, people from different political backgrounds wear, but also because it allows you to put you to define it as you want to. And I wrote the essay in the New Republic, the one you've been talking about, because I think it's important for people who don't like Trump and despise almost everything he's doing as president to take this concept seriously.
Yes, we have to do that, and we can despise it and all, but it's important to understand. We don't understand history nearly enough, but there's so much right there that we can learn. It's amazing to me how we just didn't learn from Vietnam. It was so obvious. You don't mess in other people's politics, not when they don't want you there. Anyway, you say the orange version of greatness, while not historically inaccurate, quote, captures something vital and malevolent. What does it capture that's vital and malevolent? Please explain.
Well, as I said, it's vital because I think Americans, many Americans, maybe most, we don't know, really do want to live in a country that they can look up to, where they can feel that as Americans, they're doing great things. Well, at least the country's doing great things, and they can be part of that. And I quote in the essay various people on the left, progressives like Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., who used the term greatness to define right. what America was and might be again. And so it's vital because some people don't like the idea of American patriotism, don't like the idea of wanting to be proud of your country, think it's narrow, it puts up boundaries between Americans and other people. But I disagree. You know, I think one can be a citizen of the world and be a citizen of the United States and want the country you live in, the country that you vote in, the country that you raise your children in, to be a country that you can be proud of, and because of how it acts on its ideals. And now the negative side of it, clearly, is that the idea of American greatness, which Trump talks about, does appeal to people who don't like immigrants, mm-hmm. Especially undocumented ones, but really pretty much all immigrants, at least those who don't work for a Republican, and who are, of course, opposed to labor unions, who are opposed to racial equality, who think it's a good idea to bring the army into American cities, where even though the mayors and the governors of the states don't want them there. So it appeals to a more oppressive, more restrictive, more bigoted America as well. So it does both those things.
Yeah, those are examples of malevolence, for sure. And in talking about this, you know, I consider myself a patriot. I very much dislike nationalism. It was nationalism that created this insane First World War, the Great War. I really despise nationalism, but I do consider myself a patriot. And in discussing this idea of patriotism, I mean, I'm certainly of the left, but you indirectly bring up a kind of sad memory of mine from the great anti-war movement days of the late 1960s. And that was, if you saw a house or a business displaying the American flag, one could safely assume they supported the war in Vietnam. You write, now as before, progressives cannot be effective in calling for great changes in our society if they allow their adversaries to claim the mantle of patriotism for themselves alone, end of quote. I like to think we've learned from that yielding our flag to the right was a grievous error, but we did. And nowadays when I see, you know, trucks and things waving an American flag, I don't know what side they're on. I mean, maybe they're on the same side as me. And I think that's a big, big plus, and it's a big change. It's entirely appropriate to eschew nationalism, that's for sure. It is crucial that we hold tight. We, on the traditional left, hold tight to the mantle of patriotism in order to move America to a greatness different from the very shallow and ugly one Trump offers. Are left liberals saying, I oppose Trump because I love America? How important is that needing to be said?
I think it's very important. But of course, we have to define why we love America. We can't just say we love America. We don't want to. We wouldn't want to replace one empty, vague slogan with another one.
It's true.
You know, I mean, the flag, I mean, I don't go off on a tangent here, but the flag, of course, is a marker of patriotism, yes. of a kind of allegiance to a national family, if you will. Uh-huh. And for that reason, I think it was a very, as you say, a very bad decision for people like me. I must admit, you know, I was an anti-war demonstrator, as you were, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, to give it up, and even worse, to burn flags, or to fly the flag of the Viet Cong, which was an army which was, you know, probably on the right side of the war. They were fighting for their own country, but it was also the group that was you know, killing American soldiers. Yeah, that was not going to get you a lot of support from Americans who didn't like the war but didn't feel represented by the anti-war movement either. So that's the line one has to walk, I think, between criticizing those who run the country without criticizing the country, without identifying Trump with the flag and Americanism and saying we're opposed to all that.
Yeah, we well, there. You know, we've heard the people. You know, that old shout of USA, USA. We're number one. We're number one. I find that you know, pretty offensive, I have to say. And you know, I'd like to think that greatness necessarily means that, yeah, we're great because we care about other people. I mean, there's a great quote. There's that word great quote from Bernie Sanders, who in his speeches often talks about the need to, quote, fight for that person you don't even know. Do you think his vision of American greatness fits in with the aspiration that was spoken of by Lincoln?
Yes, I think so. I mean, of course, he's never going to get elected president. He's too old now.
He is a little too old, yeah.
But I do think one of the reasons he's a very popular politician, even among young people, especially today, is because he seems to fight for his ideals. He seems you know, to have an uncompromising belief in the capacity of ordinary people to change things. And you know, you can define that as socialism, which he does sometimes. You can define it as you know, just a determination to create a more equal society. But I think he's seen as authentic in that belief, and that's I think very important. And actually, when he has defined socialism, he gave a couple speeches, in both campaigns he ran for president in 2016 and 2020. Mm-hmm. Each time he defined socialism, he defined it as not something that Lenin would have liked, or Mao would have liked, or Castro would have liked. Yeah. He defined it as sort of completing the New Deal, completing the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson without the Vietnam War. So in that sense, he was speaking about a radicalism very much in the American green.
Yes. Yes, there is a great tradition, and there I use that word again, great. It is a great tradition of American you know, patriotic leftism. I mean, there was Fighting Bob La Follette. There was this whole prairie populism thing. Of course, Trump wants to erase that history, but I would think those people, those powerful people like Bob La Follette, Senator Bob La Follette of, what was that, Wisconsin? I think so. They wanted to make America great as well. And we brought up Lincoln, of course. You can't really talk about American history without mentioning the bearded one. And in your essay in the New Republic, you point out that Lincoln used the term great a number of times in his Gettysburg Address. What do you think he meant by the word great that was applicable then that may well be even more applicable today?
Well, he used it in different ways. And as people listening probably know or remember, when hopefully you were taught the Gettysburg Address in school or read it yourself on the wall of the Lincoln Memorial here in D.C., yeah. The very short address, and he wrote it all on on the side of the back of an envelope, at least originally. I forget how long it was. It was about 1,000 words, maybe less than that. He talked about the Great War, and of course the Civil War was then and still the bloodiest war in American history, but that great, that's one definition of great, unfortunately. World War I was known as the Great War.
Yeah, because it was
World
big.
War II. He talked about the Great Battlefield, in which, you know, the Gettysburg, the Battle of Gettysburg, in 1863 was sort of a turning point in the war, leading to the Union victory. But then he talked about the great task remaining before us to make sure government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. So he used that adjective great to define something terrible and bloody, and there was killing hundreds of thousands of people, this great war, at the same time as he believed those who were fighting against slavery, who were fighting to preserve the Union, were making it possible to achieve a greater America, a better America. Yeah. So great for him meant better as well as bloody. So again, you know, we talk about words here, and words, especially when they're resonant words that are used all the time by speechmakers, by politicians, by anybody else, means very different things. But that's all the more reason to fight for better definitions of the word rather than how Donald Trump defines the word.
Yeah, we can't let him own the word great, that's for sure. And we made a big mistake letting the right own the flag back in the late 60s, early 70s. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Boy, it's a heavy lift. We need everybody involved. Our guest today is one of my favorite historians, Professor Michael Kazin, who has written an essay in The New Republic called The Two Faces of American Greatness. There's all different possibilities of how we can become great. And I'm reminded of a book I thoroughly enjoyed by a professor he was at the University of Pennsylvania, actually. Kermit Roosevelt III wrote The Nation That Never Was. And that makes me think of the aspirations that Lincoln talked about, The Nation That Never Was. And that's like greatness is still out there. We can be better. We have gone not, we haven't, are nowhere near achieving those aspirations right now. But yeah, greatness is up to the imagination of the interpreter. And as I get older, which I guess both of us are, it's better than the alternative, they say, somehow a lot of the old times do seem better. For example, when the law ruled against President Nixon, it appeared he had not the slightest question, not an inkling of a question. He had to obey the law. That was it. When he resigned, I naively thought that the rule of law triumphed for good and democracy was saved. You say the desire for better times should not be condemned as just a bigoted yearning to return to an era when straight white men ran everything. Please say more about that. You know, nostalgia can be dangerous. Imagining things being better than they were and imagining, white people in the 50s, yeah, it was peace and prosperity, but if you were not white, it was a different story. So why is it so, the idea that the desire for better times should not be condemned as just a bigoted yearning to return to an era when straight white men ran everything? Just say more, please.
Well, if you don't believe that times can be better, if you don't believe that there were some resources in the past to help you make times better, then you're going to fail at politics. You're not going to create a movement that can not just mobilize people on the streets, like with the No Kings demonstration a few months ago, but you can't. You'll not be able to build a movement that can organize people who don't agree with you already. And really, I wrote the essay for that reason, to try to sort of nudge my fellow historians, anybody else who was reading it, anybody else who's listening to this right now, to think about how can we build a majority movement on the left again, within the Democratic Party, outside the Democratic Party. Various institutions have to be part of that movement. But if you don't look to, look at the Constitution, for example, and the Constitution was written, as you know, by a group of people who included large slaveholders, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. But courts, of course, in this country, federal courts, their whole business is to decide whether the Constitution is being violated or not. And more, at least at the lower court levels, not Supreme Court so much, they are deciding that Donald Trump is violating it. There's lots of problems with the Constitution. If it was up to me, I would rewrite a lot of it. But we still have to defend the Constitution that protects us, at least in theory, against some of the kind of things which Donald Trump has been doing and his allies, his toadies, have been doing, like Stephen Miller and head of Homeland Security and so forth. That's an example, I think, of one of the ways in which one should not dismiss looking to the past, elements of the past at least, as just awful, bigoted, reactionary, because we still live with them. And until those are changed, until the Constitution's changed, which, as you know, is not easy to do.
No, and that's a good thing.
The amendment process is much harder than it should be. But nevertheless, we still have it. And, we're 240 years about from 238 years away from the anniversary of when the Constitution was ratified. We're going to have it for a long time, and we have to use it in order to stop some of the terrible things that are happening, and also to use it, as some people have used it in the past, to make America better.
Make America better. And when, again, the Lincoln words about shall not perish from the earth, I just, a lot of people have a feeling it kind of is perishing from the earth right at this moment. And, oh, man, we have to really value the Constitution and keep it alive. That, you know, America still has that, and that's keeps us great, I think, the Constitution. I mean, it's based on, of course, the Magna Carta, and, you know, it's the desire of people to self-govern. What?
And, of course, you know, there have been times when the Constitution was amended by people we would consider today progressives. During Reconstruction, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, and the 15th Amendment, giving every man the right to vote,
right.
Regardless of race or previous condition of servitude, and the Progressive Era, when there were the Income Tax Amendment, popular election of senators, and a little later, women's suffrage amendments were passed, which did, you know, make the Constitution at least somewhat better, more modern, more egalitarian.
Yeah, made America even greater. And talk about presidential slogans and you know, the word great again. Woodrow Wilson, of course, was reelected in 1917 on his slogan, he kept us out of war. Who could argue against that? The people in America saw what was going on in Europe and were like, nah, that's not for us. We don't want that. But when he was reelected, he did, in fact, the opposite. For reasons that I suspect have more to do with protecting our allies' ability to pay back the money it borrowed from us in the Great War. Your book, War Against War, strikes me of a focus on an American tradition with long-standing identity of which we can be proud. And I suggest the story in that book, War Against War, exemplifies real greatness of who we are as Americans, even though I think the feeling the sentiment against joining the Great War in Europe was the majority. It eventually, you know, war fever just absolutely took over. But that protest, that dissent, I really think, to me, that's always one of the things that's made America great. What might that greatness be that we're talking about that was there during the protests 1914 to 1918 that we should acknowledge and celebrate? What is that greatness we should celebrate?
Well, again, it's the greatness of democracy and the ability, the freedom to speak out against government policies that you think are taking the country in a very bad direction.
Yeah.
And since you mentioned, you know, this is World War One is in some ways the forgotten war for a lot of Americans. Mm. It's not a war that that most Americans know much about. I don't want to go off on a tangent talking about it, though it was very, very kind of you to mention that book. But it is true, I think, that probably until early 1917, most Americans were opposed to joining the Allies in the war against Germany and Austria-Hungary and Ottoman Empire. And not because they thought that the other side was so wonderful.
No.
but because it seemed to be a war that was between different empires, and there's no particular reason for the United States to jump into that. The U.S. had its own empire, but it was not fighting for land in Europe anyway. But what was important, I think, is that because the war was unpopular, at least before the U.S. entered it, and even was had a lot of people opposing it after the U.S. entered it in April 1917, what happened under the Wilson administration was probably the most repressive episode of a government crackdown in American history, where thousands of people were arrested, harassed. Eugene Debs, head of the Socialist Party, was put in jail for giving a speech against the draft at a picnic in Canton, Ohio in 1918. And laws were passed, the Espionage Act especially, which in effect made it possible to prosecute people and put them in jail for felonies for just speaking out against the war, for endangering the progress of the war or the draft. So that was an example, I think, of how the First Amendment was used by Americans to oppose the war and to write articles against the war, to rally people to sign petitions against the war. But then once the war was declared, very quickly, President Wilson, with the support of Congress, of Congress at least, did institute a very brutal crackdown against dissent. And that's something, a lesson that we should take to heart today, you know, more yes. than 100 years later, where President Trump and his allies and the all Republicans now are seemingly willing, of course, to stop immigrants who are here studying, for example, at my university, Georgetown, from speaking mm-hmm. out against American policy in regards to Israel and Palestine, and really basically trying to curtail the actual exercise of the First Amendment whenever they can.
And dissent is one of the most patriotic things there can be, I think. And I think, I mean, I've always thought, you know, growing up in the 50s as a genuine patriot, that dissent, as I think it was Jefferson, I may be wrong, said dissent is the highest form of patriotism. I really think it is. And you talk about, I got to make a plug for yet another book. Adam Hochschild wrote a really good book about the period of which we were just speaking, called American Midnight, about the Wilson... about the Wilson's era crackdown on dissent, and people don't know about that. And I'll tell you, about 20 years ago, the only thing I knew about World War One was that it came before World War Two.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you know how to count.
Since then, I've done a lot of reading, and I've become obsessed with it. I even went to some...
Here's a quote about the First Amendment from some guy named Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, yeah.
About whom we have a holiday. He said, somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatest for America is the right to protest for right. The greatest for America is the right to protest for right. So that sort of says it. You know, of course, one of the most important leaders in American history and one of the most eloquent speakers yeah. in American political history as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it just blows me away that he was 39 when he killed. So he did all that stuff at a really young age. What an and of course, now his legacy is, Reagan used it, but whatever. I mean, he said those things about American greatness. And I think that's really important to be said. And, that resistance to wars, such as the First World War and Vietnam, in my mind, can be rightfully said to exemplify real greatness. We should be proud that we stood up for what is right and against imperialism and against these ridiculous wars. Why then should we, as you suggest, demonstrate empathy for our fellow citizens to whom the slogan, the Make America Great Again slogan, appeals, even if we disagree with Trump's policies and dislike his egomaniacal behavior? Why, in that light, is it so counterproductive on the left for people to judge the MAGA forces as ignorant?
Well, because we need a majority.
Yeah, true.
This is democracy, right? At least supposed to be, and it still is. At least until something really awful happens. Let's hope it doesn't. And Trump, for all his terribleness, almost majority of the popular vote. He certainly won a pretty decent majority of the electoral vote. And so if you write off or you dismiss the way Hillary Clinton seemed to do, for example, in 2016, people who support MAGA, who support Trump, for whatever reason, instead of figuring out how to convince them not to support this guy, then you are, not understanding how politics, democratic nation works. As I said before, you can't just mobilize your own side. There's not enough people on our side. Mm. Everyone who loves Bernie Sanders, for example, well, great, but Bernie Sanders is not going to run again. And if he did, he'd be attacked as an un-American socialist. So as he was to a degree in 2016, 2020. So you need to win over people who, as I said before, have real grievances, about inflation, about feeling like their jobs might be lost to AI, the idea that maybe their kids won't have as good a future as they will. And Trump, again, I hate to keep saying this to an audience which is pretty much progressive probably, but, yeah. Trump appeals to people because he does speak to their discontents. Not my discontents or your discontents, but a lot of people's discontents. And when people on the left, and this includes Democrats and people to the left of Democrats, just disparage Trump, make fun of him, sometimes make fun of the people who support him.
Yes.
you know, that's not going to do the job. I mean, yes, you want to make fun of Trump. You want to discredit him any way you can.
Sure.
But don't take those same attacks and direct them towards people who are, you know, trying to live their lives, working their jobs, going to school, maybe raising their kids, and unfortunately have bought in to Trump's spiel. And because if you write them off, then you're writing off the possibility of getting a majority, a good majority, on the side of a better politics. Again, it's about organizing. And organizer used to be a sort of holy term when I was in college and was doing something other than teaching classes and writing articles and books and being on podcasts like yours. But it should be a holy word, because labor organizers, feminist organizers, anti-war organizers, organizing means you go to people who don't agree with you and you find ways to get them on your side.
Good point. See that? That's a good phrase. Could you repeat that? That's a good one.
I'm not sure I can. organizing means going to people who disagree with you, finding out why they disagree with you, and trying to convince them that they should join your side, because the arguments they've been given by Trump and by MAGA people, by Fox News or whoever else they listen to, are either inaccurate, such as vaccines are bad for you,
right?
Or they're just, you know, bigoted and dangerous, and you know,
that's a big mistake.
Most Americans, I think, don't want to be hating. They want to be haters, but they're afraid of the future. And again, that's one of the reasons why Make America Great Again appeals, because it says, well, you know, we can build a better future by going back to something which worked in the past, which, you know, isn't accurate. But going back to ideals that sometimes work in the past, that's a different matter. But you're not going to go back to, let's say, Trump probably like to go back to 1924, when there was the most restrictive immigration law in American history that was passed by Congress, which cut off almost entirely immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, and did cut off entirely immigration from China and Japan.
Yeah,
other parts of East Asia. You'd probably like to go back to something like that, but obviously that's and you'd like to add people from south of the border who are not cut off by that law. But again, we're not going to go back there if people on our side make arguments about how immigration has made the country stronger, for example.
And I before I get too far, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're with an old friend, Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University, a fairly reputable institution, I must say. He's written an article in the New Republic, The Two Faces of American Greatness. And I really think one of the important things is to, you know, after every election when Democrats have lost, I've always heard people say, oh, we just need to go out there and educate the people. No, we need to go out there and listen to the people and respect the people. What Hillary did in 2016, it was pretty openly to look down her nose at people in the heartland. They're Americans too. We can't have, I mean, there's that expression, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. It's very, very hard to do, actually, but to recognize that we have to include people, and to exclude people, it doesn't help us toward the goal of winning our agenda and making it into reality by making, you know, making enemies even angrier and insulting them. It doesn't. We need to find out what they're coming at, you know, what motivates them, what do they feel so badly about, what is this discontent all about, and try to get into that. I think that's a phase of greatness. And your essay is titled a bit simply, The Two Faces of American Greatness. What are those two faces specifically?
Well, as I was saying before, the one face is the face that celebrates power, sometimes militarism, that sees patriotism as, one face is greatness as power, power to dominate, power to conquer other countries, other peoples, power to force people to do what you want. And America's done that. Look, I'm not saying American history has been full of, you know, wonderful moments, you know, besmirched by a few bad people here and there.
Yeah.
obviously, America is a country which has expanded, you know, from the Eastern Seaboard, Europeans sort of taking over, and partially with enslaved people from Africa taking over more and more land. And the U.S. has been an empire, though not, for the most part, an empire the way European empires were, where you actually made the country sort of part of, you know, politically and juridically part of your country. The informal empire. So there's a lot of the bad kind of greatness that's been celebrated by people like Donald Trump and others. After all, he wants to take over Greenland, though I'm not sure he's been talking about that very much in recent days. But the other side of greatness is the one that I identify with and that we've been talking about for the most part this hour is the part where you uphold the ideals of America, uh-huh. the ideals of freedom, the ideas of equality, the idea that people organizing themselves, mobilizing themselves, can make the country a better place. Ordinary people, and that is something which the Constitution allows them to do. The First Amendment, especially. So you know that's the other side of greatness, I think, and. So those are the two sides, and sometimes, you know, obvious course, sometimes government power, you know, helps to promote the more progressive kind of greatness, as to the New Deal, as with passing the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s, environmental laws, but sometimes, as now, the belief in greatness helps to fuel a reactionary government like that of Donald Trump.
And we need to understand where it's coming from, why it appeals to people. I think that's really, really important to do. There is something deep at the heart of what Trump means by greatness that absolutely requires the erasure of a lot of history. And we talked a little bit about history, oddly enough, with the history pub. Who would have thunk it? Please tell us about not only the assault on teachers' ability to teach history, which is bad enough, not only the assault on the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, but the chieftains, what you call the chieftains' plan to spend $34 million on a National Garden of American Heroes stuffed with classical statues of what he calls our greatest Americans to ever live. Wow, that's not well known. Tell us about that, please, that plan.
It hasn't got a lot of attention, but it's kind of humorous in some ways, because... but not so humorous. What Trump wants to do, and is doing, as far as I know, I think he's still doing it, is he's taking much of the budget of the National Endowment for the Humanities, a institution, organization that was founded during the Great Society in the 1960s to help support historians and writers, local historical societies and others to help promote their work to educate Americans about American history and American culture. He's using $34 million of that money, which is most of their very small budget of the NEH, to give to sculptors to create classical sculptures, classical full figure statues of several hundred Americans he considers great. And it's a long list. You can look online. It includes some scientists, some presidents, some judges, some movement figures. Martin Luther King Jr. is there. Susan B. Anthony, the great suffragist, is there.
Interesting.
But so is, not surprisingly, Christopher Columbus.
Of course. Great American,
as many people probably know, never set foot on anything that became the United States. He was only in the Caribbean, you know. And of course, he also was responsible for killing a lot of Native people in the Caribbean during his voyages. This Garden of National Heroes, as Trump calls it, is a way in which he wants to install his idea of American greatness. For all time, he believes, and it's supposed to be somewhere situated, this garden, somewhere near Mount Rushmore, where Trump himself will hope to be memorialized after he dies, which is unlikely to happen. So this is a way in which he's trying to sort of substitute his own idea of what great American history is for that which most historians these days, who tend to be pretty progressive, it must be said, what we feel, you know, is American history, much more complicated history, where there are figures that I might like to put in that garden of national heroes, but he's not going to include them. Robert F. Wagner, for example, the senator from New York State who wrote the Wagner Act, which gave and still gives unions the power to have government-run elections to get unions organized in their workplaces, recognized in their workplaces. And as you mentioned, the Smithsonian, it's not just the Museum of African-American History and Culture, but Trump's has an executive order he put out a couple of months ago, which wants to redo pretty much everything in the Smithsonian Museums, including in the Natural History Museum, in the Air and Space Museum, all those museums, which are just a mile or so from me, down on the Mall in D.C. And this is in a much milder way, it's sort of what Joseph Stalin did with Russian history when he got into power, you know, sort of rewrite everything.
Yes.
Make sure all the exhibits there were, and all the art in Soviet museums was socialist realist art, which was praising, you know, the greatness of the Communist Party and the greatness of Joseph Stalin. And there's a real battle going on right now between Trump and his people and people who work at the Smithsonian, historians like myself, to try to preserve, from our side, preserve a lot of the really excellent exhibits in the Smithsonian from being done away with or being cleansed in order to make sure they have pure Trumpism at their core.
It seems to me that it's absolutely essential for dictators to erase history. And that guy with the mustache in Germany in the 1930s wanted to eliminate what he called degenerate art. Art is not supposed to be soothing. And history, I don't think, is supposed to be soothing. But that's what they're trying to do. You know, that America has always been his version of great. And there is no other version of great that has any legitimacy. There is no...
Just as with Stalin, just as with Hitler, just as with dictators.
Yep.
He's not yet a dictator, Trump, but he's like to act like one. He tries to act like one. They want only a history which will praise them, which will damn their enemies. Only they want history to do its duty.
Right.
Good history does not do anybody's duty. Good history teaches lessons, and you can take sides if you want, but the point of good history is not to take sides. The point of good history is to explain what happened in the past. And that sometimes benefits people on the left, sometimes benefits people on the right, but that's not the point. The point is not to make history a political weapon. The point is to make history something which accurately, you know, explains what happened in the past. And as you say, a lot of times it's not pretty, but uplifting. But then if you want uplifting, write a song, you know. You can sing the Star-Spangled Banner forever, but that's not going to explain what happened and why the Star-Spangled Banner was written.
Yeah, I think of the boisterous chants of USA, USA. It makes people feel good, I suppose. Like, yeah, USA. It's just great. It's great. It's great. It doesn't get you anywhere. And I've long thought that, you know, one of the points of history is to help young people learn the skill of critical thinking. But boy, they are against critical thinking. They don't want any critical thinking whatsoever, I believe. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Live. We're talking about history. We're talking about greatness, what greatness means, with one of my favorite authors, Michael Kazin, a professor of history at Georgetown University. His new article in the New Republic is The Two Faces of American Greatness. What is greatness? You know, is there what possible terms are there that can be greatness? Can we be a lot greater than we are now? Do we have to settle for? I think what Trump and his people mean, some of these so-called originalists, is that, you know, in America, as you said, it was founded by rich white men who owned people. And I think that's what they mean, some of them, by American greatness, and they want to get back to that. Make America great again. They kind of want to do that. You assert that, quote, if those who want America to be great do not insist on reforming what ails it, they mouth nothing but self-defensive cant. Please say more about that.
Again, just criticizing what Trump does, what people, what Trump is doing with history, what Trump is doing with defining greatness. It's easy, you know, it's easy to say he's terrible in this way, he's terrible in this way, he's terrible in this way. One of the things I think progressives have gotten themselves into a bind about, I wrote an article about this in The Nation back in March, I think it was, is that they've become conservative in a way. That is, they're trying to, you know, say, well, we did all these great things in the 1960s and right afterwards, and there were some wonderful things for, you know, defending equal rights for all races, same-sex marriage being legalized, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not enough. As I said before, you know, a lot of Americans aren't happy with the way things are going, not just white Americans either. As you know, Trump got a larger black vote, a larger Latino vote, a larger Asian American vote in 2024 than he did in 2016 and in 2020. So just to talk about that, you know, what's wrong is not gonna work. Also, as it says in this quotation, those who talk about make America great again, and Trump especially is guilty of this. They have very vague ideas of what would make it great again. Now, you know, Trump's main and the one thing he really does believe in terms of policy, I think, is these tariffs. Going back to William McKinley, McKinley's tariff in the 1890s, and McKinley became president in 1896, partly because he was a defender of strong tariffs. If you think tariffs, strong tariffs, are going to bring industry back to the United States, then you don't understand why so many products that Americans enjoy are not made in the United States anymore. You can say they should be, but that's not going to build your cell phone in the United States. It's not going to, obviously, have most of the gas in your car made in the United States. It's not going to have your kids' toys made in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to become a nation which makes everything for itself again. Even in the past, we were not that way, but certainly not going to happen now.
It's an illusion of greatness.
Exactly. So that's why I call it self-serving, self-defensive cant, because he's defending what he thinks is returning to American greatness by wanting everything to be made in the United States, but if he thought for a second, he'd know that's not going to happen. And in fact, it shouldn't either, because it's better. Yes, we probably should have more manufacturing here, but it's better, in fact, if you have high-wage manufacturing in different parts of the world, and people, you know, buy products that are better made in some countries than in other countries, and tariffs are low tariffs, for the most part, help to make those products cheaper. So there's good things about free trade as well as bad things. It's certainly true that. As Sherrod Brown, one of my favorite
senators,
running for Senate again next year, says, is that, you know, Democrats and progressives generally, liberals in general, didn't understand what a loss it was when in his own state of Ohio, the steel mills closed down and the auto plants closed down in the 80s and 90s. That set the stage for Trump making the argument about opposing free trade and high tariffs, which he has. At the same time, Trump has no answers either.
And that, you know, and to yearn for that period when, you know, a man could earn enough for and have a stable job making cars or steel or you know, heavy manufacturing that used to be done in Ohio, for example. You know, and to yearn for that version of American greatness isn't such a bad thing. But, you know, it is well into the 21st century now.
Those are hard jobs, but they were pretty well paid.
Yeah.
Because those people had unions.
What a concept.
And that's in the mid-50s when probably when Trump says make America great again, maybe some people who have any idea of the 50s maybe think about the 50s as a time he might be evoking. That's a time when almost 35% of the American labor force were members of unions, and it was almost all private sector unions, very few public employees within members of unions. So, and that's a time when everything Trump is doing in terms of labor unions that would sabotage that possibility.
And one very frightening thing is that Trump, you know, by sending troops into the Democratic cities, he's frankly making war on a lot of Americans, it seems. And you write that for democracy to steer a country toward greatness, you refer to William James, who cautioned that there must be, quote, good temper between parties. Now, when I was in the New Hampshire State Senate, 1990-2004, long time ago, there was indeed good temper between the parties. Now it's basically war, sometimes with actual violence. What's your sense of the prospect of civility returning in that aspect of greatness?
Well, I don't know about New Hampshire, live free or die state.
But it was typical Republicans then. They were genuine conservatives. They weren't Trumpists.
Sure. Like, what was the my favorite 20th century New Hampshire Senator, you know, George Aiken, Republican, who said we should declare victory in Vietnam and leave.
He was actually from Vermont, but he was one of my favorite senators, too.
Sorry.
That's all right. Vermont is to the left of New Hampshire in more ways.
But it wasn't them.
anyway, he was a Republican, but a very decent, and there used to be these Republicans who were.
As you know, New Hampshire and Vermont used to be known as Red Rock Rib Republican.
Yes.
Because of the granite and the tradition. Civility, unfortunately, is usually possible in American history when one party is really dominant over the other one.
True.
And then the other party has to go along. I mean, there was civility in the 1930s to a degree. There was civility, obviously, World War II, because it was the people united over the war. And there was some civility in the early 1960s when the Democrats were dominant. And something that a lot of people probably don't know, that the vote on the Civil Rights Act in the Senate, overcoming a Southern filibuster, more Republicans supported the Civil Rights Act than Democrats. Some of the Democrats at the time were Southerners who opposed integration of all facilities and also opposed black people voting. But I think too that, you know, some of the things we've been saying here, I do think it would make America a more civil society if people on both sides respected the views of people on the other side.
That's so important.
Disagreeing with them tremendously, sure, but it's a good thing, I think, to have debates between people on different sides, and not the kind of debates one has on social media, where it's basically like two junkyard dogs barking at each other and then backing away from each other because they don't want to draw blood. This issue of the New Republic that my article is in was edited by an excellent historian, David Blight from Yale, who wrote a great Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Frederick Douglass. And David Blight, after this issue came out, which had other articles by other historians too about Trump and history, David Blight invited, I think his name is Paul Roberts, who's the chair of the Heritage Foundation to have a debate about the meaning of American history, the debate has not been scheduled yet, but it should happen sometime this fall between a esteemed historian on the left and I'm not sure who's esteemed, but at least someone who's definitely was a historian on the right as well. And that's, as much as I dislike Trump's politics, I think that's the kind of debate we should be having because, again, as I said before, you have to convince people. You don't have a civil society if people stop trying to convince each other in a civil way.
That would be great, dare I say, to have that debate. I hope it happens. Your essay on Two Faces of American Greatness ends with some words of wisdom from Langston Hughes, from a poem he wrote. Would you please share a few of those words which you think we need to understand today?
Sure, and just in case people don't know, Langston Hughes was a very fine African-American poet. He was part of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s. He was close to the Communist Party, though probably not a member for a while during the 1930s, when the Communist Party was, among other things, a pretty anti-racist institution.
That was the only one at the time, as I recall. Yeah.
And also, he was a closeted homosexual. So he was not somebody who one would expect to be a great admirer of American greatness. This is what he wrote in one of his great poems written in the 1940s. And you sense in the poem, I think, the ambivalence of believing in America, but the necessity of it anyway. So Hughes wrote this: "Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love, where never kings connive, nor tyrants scheme, let any man be crushed by one above. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, where opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe." Then he added, "There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this, quote, homeland of the free." Then he ended, "We must take back our land again, America. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet, I swear this oath, America will be."
Yeah. That's a greatness I can certainly subscribe to. Very and very interesting stuff. And it's so important for us to understand each other and to think about what greatness could be. You know, we don't have to make America great again. We can make America great in the future, for the future, for, you know, and learn from our history. I know that's a radical concept, to learn from our history, but what do I know? And thank you, Michael Kazin. The article is "To Two Faces of American Greatness in the New Republic." He also writes for The Nation, a whole bunch of good magazines, written a whole bunch of really good books, I must say. Thank you so much for being with us today. It was, dare I say, great.
All the pleasure, Bert. Thank you.
Thank you. This monologue is by Jeff Daniels from the movie The Newsroom.
"There is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We lead the world in only three categories: number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed, we cared about our neighbors, we put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We aspired to intelligence, we didn't belittle it, it didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy."
If you enjoyed that discussion, subscribe. It's all free. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website.